the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Richard Lawson. President Biden has reiterated his calls for a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah after the Iranian-backed group confirmed the death of Hassan Nasrallah in Israeli airstrike. Speaking to reporters in the American state of Delaware, Mr. Biden said the death of Hezbollah's leader was a measure of justice for his victims. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his killing was necessary to achieve his country's war goals.
At the start of the week, I came to the conclusion that the intense blows the Israeli military struck Hezbollah within the past days, these blows will not be enough. Nasrallah's assassination was an essential condition to achieving the goals we set. Returning safely the residents of the north to their homes and changing the balance of power in the region over the years.
Well, Iran has promised to avenge Hassan Nasrallah's death, stoking fears of regional escalation. The Israeli military said they intercepted a missile fired by the Houthis in Yemen. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner says a full-blown regional conflict in the Middle East wouldn't be in anyone's interest, but is possible.
It really hinges on three questions. What will Hezbollah do next? What will Iran and its proxies do next? And what will Israel do next? So in the case of Hezbollah, they are hurt, they're bleeding, their weapons dumps have been blown up, but they've still got a very big arsenal buried below ground, which includes these long-range missiles. Now, there will be some in their ranks who are baying for blood. The question is, do they unleash this big long-range arsenal of missiles trying to overwhelm Israel's air defences on cities like Tel Aviv? They could probably do that, but the response from Israel would be catastrophic for Lebanon.
Millions of Americans are still without power and face severe flooding in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. One of the most powerful storms to ever hit the United States battered the southeast with heavy rains and winds of up to 140 miles per hour. The police have charged three people with the murder of a man who was stabbed to death in Norwich. The body of 19-year-old Calvin Taylor was found in a flat last Saturday. Sport now. Liverpool are leading the Premier League after Mo Salah's penalties secured their 2-1 win against Wolverhampton Wanderers at Molineux. The Wolves boss Gary O'Neill said all it took was one lapse in concentration after his side equalised in the second half.
Disappointed that we went off plan for about a minute where just after we scored and for some reason we get carried away and caught in the emotion of it and go chasing and open the game up once, really, and get punished for a penalty. Apart from that minute where we lost our way and went chasing and opened the game up, I thought the lads were excellent.
Turning now to the weather forecast. A clear night in the south and east, but rain in northern Scotland. Cloud and wind moving in from the southwest. And that's the BBC News at 3 minutes past midnight.
BBC Radio 5 Live. Exciting times in F1.
This Sunday from 1.
Marina Bay Street Circuit.
Singapore.
Can Red Bull turn around their fortunes on a track that they haven't got good history at? Or are McLaren in a league of their own now?
Listen to live coverage of every lap
on 5 Sports Extra and BBC Sounds.
Now on 5 Live, Sports Strangest Crimes, Confessions of a Match Fixer. You can also hear the full series now on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The following podcast contains some strong language. Previously on Confessions of a Match Fixer. If I was to look at all the managers I've had, Mark was the closest thing to home. That quickly changed. I'm losing my edge in training and in games. My daughter can't come into this world whilst I'm on the back foot. My teammates come up to me and like, right, Moses. You know there's these guys that fix matches. I just knew going into that meeting, they may be 60 grand that I'm willing to take by any means necessary. So leading up into that game, I was like, I'm doing it.
So not only are you in, you're in the point of I'm doing this with you or without you. Like you've just fully committed that this first game, Eastbourne.
Did you have a fee?
So just over like 100 grand.
Okay.
Yeah, just over, this was like five players, 20 grand each. That was the only thing that was on my mind, Troy. A 21st of August 2012, Eastbourne versus Bromley. For the fix to be successful, we need to be 2-0 down by half-time.
I remember that game very... It was almost like it was yesterday. You know when you play certain away games, you just... There's something in the air. Like, floodlights are lit, pitch is flat. But all I can think about was... If this is actually true, there's still an element of it's too good to be true. In the first 5 minutes of that game, that I'm telling the wingers to hold back, but they're attacking. Everyone that was at that meeting, they were playing like they're trying to go to the Premier League. And I'm like,
what are you doing?
Like, I can't shout on the pitch, but I'm like, yo, like,
remember what you said.
Relax on a counter attack.
Yeah.
Like, I quickly realised that in that moment that even though you can say you'll do something, you're having natural human instincts that ain't allowing you to do that. So imagine I get the ball and I try and go forward. I'm naturally going to do it. So I can see the hesitancy in what they're trying to do, but it's really strange. They actually ended up playing better, Trey.
Well, because...
That's what's crazy. They actually played better in that game than they did a lot of games that weren't fixed. But in that moment, it's almost like a switch turned on and off. My switch was...
Guilty conscience, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And all like on a pitch whilst they're shouting, remember, we're not in front of 10, 15, 20,000.
Yeah, you hear every word.
You hear every word and I'm like, yeah, we're trying. We're trying.
Yeah.
Like, chill, we're trying. Midfielder's run into the box. He's giving away a pen and I'm like, he wasn't even involved. So he ain't getting paid. They went 1-0 up. But as the time ticking, the striker played for a county and a district when we were younger. But I knew he was one of the best strikers in the league. And I'm like, I'm actually trying to help you score goals and you can't score. Man, this is open play. This is like halfway line, get the ball and turn type of stuff. He weren't even doing that.
Okay.
On a flat pitch. I don't want to run the risk of having another meeting, but I don't know what the outcome of that meeting will be because do you now owe them $5,000?
All these thoughts going through your mind as the game's going on.
Yeah, man. And remember, in Eastbourne Stadium, you have the clock. I just remember looking back at the clock, 45 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I'm like, nah, man, this ain't happening.
This bit then, like 43, 44, I know your clock watching thinking,
I'm looking at the clock and I'm hearing, I'm trying. Ball's gone out wide. One of the wingers is the worst defensive person in our squad and he's just running back and I'm thinking, fucking hell, man. Like, I'm looking at the clock and as he's crossed the ball, he's like, kind of crossed it mid, but he, winger, or it might even been the fullback, he's cut in, but if there was video on that game, you'd have seen him grab the ball. That's not about it. Like, he literally grabbed the ball and put his hands in his head and I'm like, oh my days, pen. Then I remember having that feeling in my chest, like, of anxiety and not nerves, more so like panic. It's almost like an adrenaline rush. Bang, goal goes in, 2-0. Then I remember going in at halftime, putting my head down and the gaffer was like, what the fuck is going on?
I'm Moses Swebu, and this is Confessions of a Match Fixer, Episode 3, The Middleman.
I just thought it's too good to be true, man. No, this is way too good to be true. It's the only thing that was running in my mind. I went on my phone and all I saw was a thumbs up from the translator. Thumbs up. So I was like, going back to the meeting that we had at Mayfair Hotel, the moment the fix is in, play normal.
Yeah.
So when we've come out in the second half, now it's back to normal. So if you had watched that game, you would have known something would have happened because everyone's playing like on the front foot. We're attacking defensively, I'm marking right side, dropping short, being aggressive. almost playing the puppet master in a game.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a game of chess. He's taken something. Where do I come back? They ended up scoring again. The game ended 3-0.
Mm-hmm.
After that game, it was actually said in a change room, my unlucky boys.
Player to player. Did you not feel bad at any point in that?
Trey, if I'm going to be honest with you, man, no emotion came through my body, man.
Now, what I mean by that is, this is me saying now, like, let me be really fair. I think you do love football. But I don't think you love football. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
I love football. And me hearing you go like, oh, it's all right because I got 20 bags. Like,
yeah.
I'm fuming. And I'm not even playing. But how the fuck can you sit there and be like, we lost that game and I got 20K and I'm happy?
Yeah, that's...
It's a mental thing for me. To be fair, I don't let the kids win at chess at home. Like, that ain't happening. I've got to win. Do you get what I mean? So,
but you're right. You're right in what you're saying because... Like, if I'm going to be brutally honest and give it to you 100%, I didn't even care. In that moment, I didn't give a shit.
After the game had finished, the players were like, yeah, we've done it. I've got a phone call. A voice and an accent I didn't even recognise. He said,
Moses, I was at the game. Let's go to the Mayfair Hotel.
And that's how I first met the syndicate's middleman.
Eastbourne to London was probably like an hour and a half, 2 hour journey back.
Yeah.
So, man that came to watch the game jumped in my car.
So the middleman said to me, you know what I'm going to do? Because I know you tried. You're going to take all their money. And I said, what do you mean? And he was like, you're going to take all their money. I was like, I've never done this to take all their money. He said, if you don't take it, then I will. And I'm like, you can't do that. And he's, I can do whatever I like. So I'm driving the car with him next to me and we're arguing. Instincts start to kick in.
And I remember the players just pinging me like, where's the money, where's the money, where's the money? And he's explaining, let's check into the Mayfair Hotel.
Yeah.
The money's going to come in 24 hours. And I'm like, there's no way we're leaving you.
Yeah.
So I told the boys, come to the Mayfair Hotel. Everybody's going to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to book a room and we'll wait the 24 hours. Throughout that night, no one believed that the money was coming. This middleman gave us that feeling that he's going to do something with that money the moment it comes. So it weren't cool, smooth, relaxed. So the following morning, he explained that the money's going to go over to East London, that I have to go and drive from the Mayfair Hotel and pick that up. I've gone from Mayfair Hotel in my car.
You go on your own?
No, I went with the middleman, drove all the way to East London. But throughout that whole journey, he just kept saying to me, Moses, keep the money. Don't give it to them. I was there at the game. I watched the game. Don't give it to them.
Right.
And that's my teammates.
Yeah, so I'm looking at him like he's the snake in all the...
Yeah.
Are you not? Because I'm thinking... And we're by far not the same people, but I think we've got the same tendencies. And you're not thinking here, you plus Guy X are travelling. In my head, I'm thinking this is a setup. By listening to it.
You know what? I already took the risk, though. So, again, my mentality back then was, in a weird way, I was prepared for whatever came, if that makes sense. So let me give an example. Not in a violent way or like something bad's going to happen, but I'm ready for what I've signed up for.
Yeah.
As in, you know what? F it. Mm. Whatever happens, happens. If it happens, there's money at the end of this. If it don't, we just ain't doing it again, but I've got my $5,000.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a win-win situation.
So we arrive in Canning Town. This is where we're supposed to get the money. Someone's going to turn up, but there's no one there. We have to wait. Me and him sat in a car.
So you're saying you sat in the car with this middleman?
Yeah.
Don't really know. It's not a great relationship. Yeah.
But what was really unique about that moment, he's French, by the way, so leaving the following morning to go back to France.
Okay.
So as of tomorrow, the Frenchman isn't even going to be the middleman no more.
I'd connected his phone to the car.
Okay.
He got a phone call from the boss. So the boss has rang him, and I pressed the button straight away.
Like, answer, yeah.
The translator's translating is like, did the players get paid? I was like, no, not really. This is what happened. And I explained we had to wait 24 hours, players had to come, players are not happy because we weren't sure the money was going to get given. He was like, take this number, put the number in my phone. He was like, send me a text. Then he sent me a text and he was like, come and meet us. So the Frenchman's going back to France and now I've got a meeting lined up with the actual match fixers. But that was for later, because in that moment, I was only focused on getting that money. I think we're waiting for around 20 to 30 minutes before someone actually showed up. It looked like a student.
Yeah.
The bag came in Sainsbury's bags.
Okay.
And I remember as he's handed it over the car window, he just put it like at a footwell.
So,
I drive back from Canning Town back to Mayfair Hotel. I'm driving my automatic car with one leg and I'm like shifting all the cash over and like pushing the seat back.
Yeah.
All the way down, and I'm like racing like a Formula One car, and it's probably like $100,000 just on a footwell. Sorry.
Are you in a situation at that point? If you get pulled with cash now,
yeah, game over.
Game over. So yeah, are you more nervous driving back than you were going there to get it? If you get what I mean.
That's the first time since I had that car I actually put two hands on the wheel. Like, I'm being serious. I put 10 o'clock or 12 o'clock. I didn't even look left and right. I had tints, so I wound the windows down.
Yeah.
So anyone looking into the car will see two black guys.
Yeah.
So I knew, if worst case, that, if I'm going to be honest with you, Trey, if police had pulled us, I would have stopped.
Yeah.
Like, I'd have run the risk of running off and probably leaving that car.
If you just fix the game, you've got
100%.
Dodgy geezer in your car, you don't know. You've got $100,000 cash.
In my Bromley tracksuit.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is what any young person should do, but I'd have gone off London Bridge like I'm Fast and the Furious. You've got a decision to make now.
Mm.
I'm talking for you, but I feel like I've morphed into you in this situation. Your play is either one of three things. You go with a guy in your car and go, let's go spend this money, it's all mine. You go, two, let's go back to my lads, we divvy up the money, one time was enough. And then the third is, I can be the boss here. And I can really take this to where it needs to go.
Yeah, that's fair. The last one was spot on, man. I think when I'm driving back, and obviously I've never had that amount of money in my possession ever, it weren't until I actually got to the hotel and I saw the glint in everyone's eyes. But remember, they're thinking they're getting $20,000. And I'm like, nah, I'm taking the third route.
But what makes you go, F these, you're going to get this? Because if I'm just thinking long-term play, You're probably going to do this again.
Mm-hmm.
You probably want to use the same people again.
Yeah.
You probably don't want to stiff them in the first one.
Yeah.
You can pay them, or you can go, nah, I'm the boss now. You'll get what you're given.
That's what I did.
I know that's what you did, but I'm trying to understand why you did that. Like, on the drive back, all this stuff's going through your head on the way back, I imagine. You've got the cash now. You've got the direct contact to the big boss. Now you've got these lads. Is it a fair assumption to say? And you can correct me if I'm wrong. You're looking at, like, these guys ain't going to do nothing anyway. The players. Like, you know, with want of a better word, is a sausage. He ain't going to do nothing. So he'll get what he's given.
Do you know what I quickly realised? These lot ain't really my friends. So why would I treat them? Why am I treating them like an equal? So whilst the players, I didn't give them $20,000. I gave them some money.
Yeah.
And they were pissed off and they were like, yeah, nah, man, you're ripping us off. I was like, this is where it is, man.
Mm-hmm.
Then I asked them one question and I said, if you want in, you got to be 100. If you don't, this is going to happen with or without you. Yeah, I think
your play is from, you didn't know this was going to be your route. Whatever line of work you wanted to go into, you was going to be successful. whichever line of work you want to go to. Because you're too smart to not. It's just this excited, yeah, this, for want of a better word, tickled your balls, and you were like, I'm going with that, because I like it. It's fast, it's quick, it's... Do you know what I mean? There's a lifestyle, there's a notoriety towards it. And I see it with a lot of criminals, whether it be mafia or people that you know around the streets, they can read people. It's a skill set you've got. You can go like, bang, I know that, I know that, I know that. I can read a room in 10 seconds. I think you learn that from streets and looking, and when I'm on the back of the bus and he goes to that school and that one goes to that school, and that, I think you learned them lessons then and then just got better at it. 10,000 hours of practice all the time, all the time. Fair?
Yeah, that's fair. What really helped me in my career was I need to be away from everything. If I focus on myself and like I build that darkness in my mind, I know what that feeling when I was 8 years old can bring on a pitch. So I was like, you know what? Nothing ain't important right now. It wasn't until I had that conversation with the main guy, I was like, no, you know what? I'm going to get to the stage where I need to be able to be the middleman and more.
I feel like in every mafia movie, every game, there's always a big boss. And in this one, you said he's 5 foot, but he's still had the demeanour of someone that was big. So he's like, right, this is the guy that I want, because everything...
Middleman's gone to France.
Yeah, everything's
picture,
Because I know he spoke to you in the car.
Yeah.
He said, you know, come and meet me. Can you walk us through them steps?
So the real personal one-to-one meeting with them took place just off Tower Bridge.
Okay.
So I booked like Airbnb at the time. It's like a part hotel.
Yeah.
Booked it under my name, and then I just remember walking in and there was like 20 cigarettes on the floor. I was thinking, what the, like, I'm gonna lose my deposit here.
Yeah.
Then he explained, who do I know in the football ladder at like within the conference staff? Then who do I know?
Were they very particular in what teams and what league?
In the beginning, they were very particular around what teams and what league.
So they wanted to stay out of the football league?
Wanted to completely stay out of the football league. For example...
Is that for regulation and all that, I'm assuming?
Probably for scrutiny.
Yeah.
So here's a phone. He gave me a phone. And he was like, yeah, this is your new number. Don't text, don't call. When that phone call rings, we'll tell you what you're going to do next. So what days do you train? Train on Tuesdays and Thursdays, matches on Saturdays. Come see us on Monday and Wednesday, those 2 days.
From one meeting, you've gone, like, now you're middlemaning, you're looking at the league, you're having conversations at the point where he's like, how far do you want to take it? For want of a better word, you're balls deep at this point, aren't you?
Next time on Confessions of a Match Fixer. You go to this room that could be a toilet, but there's a door, there's a lock, you open the lock, then the money's stacked. It went well over past my knees up until like my torso, and I'm almost 6'3". And I'd be like, oh shit, that's a lot of money, man. I didn't like how that made me feel.
Yeah, I'm with you. I get that.
I was paranoid as fuck.
On BBC Sounds, this is Sport's Strangest Crimes. From the man who tried to buy cricket.
One night, one game, winner take all, $20 million.
The kidnap of a super horse.
It must have been terrifying.
Of course it was. How we got through with it all.
An ill-advised errand changing F1 forever.
It will haunt the people involved for as long as they live.
A $1 trillion takeover which never took off.
Fraudsters of this level, they will never stop.
The mysterious death of a superstar cyclist.
Entering the world of professional cycling was like joining the mafia.
And teammates becoming bitter enemies at one of the biggest football clubs in the world.
Betrayal. Plots. We've gone beyond women's football in France.
Sport's Strangest Crimes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The following podcast contains some strong language. Previously on Confessions of a Match Fixer. Went on my phone and all I saw was a thumbs up from the translator. The fix is in. I'm driving my automatic car with one leg and I'm like shifting all the cash, and there's probably like $100,000 just in a football.
From one meeting, you've gone, like, you're looking at the league, you're having conversations at the point where he's like, how far do you want to take it? for want of a better word, you're balls deep at this point, aren't you?
Match fixing is not simply a sort of victimless crime. That's like anything that's connected to large international criminal syndicates. You know, it feeds into other endeavors they have, from drug peddling to prostitution, human trafficking, political corruption, etc. And it's all part of a larger flow of the illegal movement of money, the illegal manipulation and movement of cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
The match fixer that you see is outgoing, gregarious, social, good with people. His pockets are full of cash. He's a fun guy to be around. But behind him, really, are these other layers of people. And when you talk about the most sophisticated match fixing operations, they trace back to Southeast Asia. And they're really looking at people like yourself and others in the game as marks, as targets, as people to corrupt simply for their own venal goals.
I'm Moses Swaybo, and this is Confessions of a Match Fixer, Episode 4, Taking Over the League. Up until now, you've mainly heard me talking to Troy. I can only talk about match fixing from my point of view. So to get a bigger perspective, I need to speak to others. People who can tell me more about just how big and dangerous it can be. So I contacted this guy and we got on a video call.
My name is Brett Forrest. I'm an investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And I'm also the author of a book called The Big Fix, which is about match fixing. Match fixing is the scourge of the game, and it's also sort of the dirty secret. Match fixing has been around since there have been matches in just about every sport in human history. But if we want to talk about football or soccer, as it's known in my country, boy, it's rampant throughout the game, principally because the game is so popular everywhere. Interpol said that the market for only football or soccer betting internationally, annually, is $1 trillion.
$1 trillion.
It's an incredible number. It's hard to get your head around it, right? And that combines both legal and illegal betting. Think about the fact that $1 trillion a year is sitting there and acting as sort of a cloak behind which you can place your match fixing bets. And the real problem here is that so many of these games are offered on betting sites, and many of these gambling sites are in the black or gray market administered by organized crime throughout the world, principally in Asia.
And would you say this is something that's gone on for decades?
So I wouldn't say that it's a recent phenomenon. I mean, there are several sort of seminal moments in the history of match fixing. And you might look at an episode, which I'm sure you're aware of, called the Lights Out scandal, the Lights Out fix, which was really the first attempt by an Asian criminal syndicate to disrupt, to influence the outcome of an EPL match.
Maybe you remember this. Around 1997, a string of Premier League matches ground to a halt when the floodlights failed. It was all over the news.
The Premier League is to investigate the standards of power supplies at football grounds after a match last night between Wimbledon and Arsenal was abandoned when floodlights failed at Selhurst Park. It's the third time this season that a Premiership game has been blacked out.
Fans thought the floodlights were failing because the stadiums were getting old, but that wasn't what was going on at all. It was actually part of a plan by the Asian syndicate.
And what they did, basically, they had an inside guy who was working at the facility who they brought into the scheme, and they prevailed upon him to shut the lights off at an opportune moment in the match.
In some betting markets, like the Far East, if the game goes beyond half-time, the bookies will pay out
on full-time results even if the game is abandoned. So with the floodlight scam, the match fixers were literally stopping the game the moment they got the result they needed.
That really was a watershed moment, because that showed the criminal elements in Southeast Asia were getting that ambitious and that brazen, and they were getting their act together to be able to place the amount of bets at the right time to reap a great reward. So from that point on, we've seen criminal syndicates in Asia blossom in terms of match fixing, become ever more brazen. And, you know, it's not just the fact that each country has a national team, or many countries have professional leagues, but there are so many different strata of the game in every country, from youth leagues to different levels of professional leagues. So while fans of the game may not be confronted with the issue because they're watching the best leagues with the most well-paid players, players, referees, coaches, managers, administrators at some of the lower levels of the game, they are the most vulnerable to corruption.
That's fair.
Yeah, I would say your experience is not common. It's not the common one for a player. What you were attempting to do was actually, you know, get more deeply involved in the machinations of understanding how the machine works.
Yeah.
The syndicate recruited me to identify which players to approach to fix across my patch in the Conference South, and then to make payments to those players after they'd done what they said they would do. It began for me in the game we played against Eastbourne in August 2012. But after just a few months, the pace picked up and matches were fixed across multiple clubs. And as it turned out, I was good at it.
All right, I'm ready. Cool. You're deciding who, what, where. How do you go? That player from, I don't know, Solly or Moores, that's the one I'm going to do. What's that process like?
So what you want to do is really figure out who the most influential person is.
Okay, what's the process for that?
So a process, who's captain, who's vice-captain?
Yeah.
Who's been there for more than 2 years? Who's gone there and come back? How many games have played in, like, the last 2 years?
This is the thing. To be the middleman, you've got to build a network. The players I knew in a Conference South were mainly at clubs in and around London. It was impossible for me to get to know every player in the teams further afield, but I always had my ways.
So if you don't know someone in that team, you may reach out to someone on social media. Or, because I was out so much, Dre, I knew where every footballer from Conference to the Premier League hangout went, gambled, betted, so through a connection in a club or in a casino or, like, in just general life, I can have a conversation with someone and be like, oh, you know what? Such and such plays for this. Like, what's he doing next season, for example?
Mm-hmm.
And usually 9 times out of 10, through understanding and doing it like that, the majority of people turn around and said yes. So imagine a pool of, like, 50 players wanting in on just being able to get paid.
What was the selection process for this group of 50, you just said 50 players desperate to get in?
To be fair, like, I don't know how it is up at the top level, but it's not hard to find out what a wage budget is. It's not hard. Even, like, I knew how much managers are on. I'll ask a question like, oh, Gaffer, if we sign a new manager, like, you know, I've played in the Football League, how much could you pay him? Oh, yeah, maybe like £1,500 a week. Or,
okay.
I'm so like, okay,
you
so.
You kind of try to just.
Yeah, so.
Get the information, but you. You're using people, using your friend, using your contacts to get
Yeah. So I said to myself, there ain't no one in any, whether you're top team or at the bottom, no one ain't paying, getting paid more than the manager. So £1,500 is the benchmark. Why am I going to pay players £5,000? Just don't need to do that. Give them £1,000.
Yeah.
Those times where I'll have to sit in on meetings with players when matches were fixed. So team A will play team B. I'll get a phone call. Can I cross-reference what players I know? So if it weren't Bromley, I could be like, oh, I can reach that person at Hayes and Yedden. Then the boss will want me present at the meeting and I'll just get a fee for that. That could have been anything from £500 to £2,500, depending on how
just
many people.
Yeah.
Depending on how many people have turned up. And what he'll do is say, the moment that match is fixed, wait 24 hours. Moses will come to the hotel, pick up your money. Then you meet him in central London and distribute the money to the players. That was part of my job, collecting the cash once it had been gathered from the bookies. And doing that took me to several places. I'm going to establish businesses. Mm-hmm. Still around today, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You go in a restaurant, you go to this room that could be a toilet, but there's a door, there's a lock. You open the lock, then the money's stacked. And I'll be like, oh shit, that's a lot of money, man. So it went well over past my knees up until like my torso, and I'm almost 6'3". So if I'm flicking through it, I can bundle them up and stack them in rubber bands at the time, which it was, then sealing it with clinfilm. Then as I sealed it with clinfilm, so depending on what type of duffel bag or bag I have, I can always accommodate to compress the money and put it in a safe place because it was wrapped so tight. I didn't even use bubble wrap. I just kept wrapping it with clinfilm every other time and using my hands to actually count the money as well. Whilst I was carrying that money, I just had like a big bag that looked like I was going to the gym. Yeah. Well, there was times where I wear my Bromley tracksuit.
Yeah, yeah.
And have like a duffel bag and my wash bag, but there's a lot of money in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I put towels on top of it. Get on a train, underground. I always get in a black cab and a taxi as well. So even one time, Trey, I had a day where I took a lot of money back to my house and I couldn't sleep.
Just because it was there?
Just because it was there. And I didn't, mm-hmm. I didn't like how that made me feel.
Yeah, I'm with her. I get that. I was
paranoid as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
Just by...
Who followed me? Who was on the train?
On the train? Did my neighbour see something?
Mm-hmm.
If I lose that money, it's not mine. So I didn't want the feeling of having a phone call or someone saying, where's the money gone? Because imagine telling your superior, your boss, oh yeah, I've lost £500,000. You're not really competent for you to lose that amount of money and you don't know where it's gone. I can almost imagine what they would have said. So almost the paranoia I got made me move in a way where I'm like, I just got to read situations and rooms and try and be as normal and just blend in. So I didn't wear anything flashy. There was rarely times I drove. And when I did drive, it's because I had to. The thing is, despite the paranoia, I actually liked it.
What made you like working for the syndicate? Was it the discipline? Was it the simplicity of it? What was it?
So working with the syndicate very much reminded me of my early beginnings navigating through football. You have to be on time. You have to do what you say. You have to say what you do. You have to work in a team. You have to work in a group. And I liked the discipline. I liked the structure. It was actually an attraction for me before I met them, and even more so when I was actually involved. So a lot of the meetings that I had with them weren't even about match fixing. I remember I used to go into the casinos and restaurants and just sit there and just learn for an hour or 2 hours, or every time I'd met different members of their syndicate. Just being able to sit down and figure out, like, how does this work and why? And like,
yeah, of course. What were they making per game in this situation? Like, just rough finger in the air. Because we hear about, like, you guys got 100K or you got 20K. What do you reckon they were making in a ballpark figure to make this a viable situation?
Like, a few million, as in they were making.
Per game?
I'll say on one of the games was a million. Yeah.
Wow.
And I know that because when I went to the restaurant, they showed me a system or platform, if you want to call it that, that showed our team names and how much was being put in live, like actually in play.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time where, well, there was an evening game. I'd gone to meet them and he showed me the match being played out and who was doing what. And the odds on that market were moving up and down. Red, green, green.
This is in play betting before in play was a thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I didn't even know what in play betting was. So when I started to see that and it was in Chinese, converted into pound, I was like, yeah, a million.
Wow. I've always wondered, how do you make sure the money's not traceable? Because anyone who's on the right side of the law, that's a fear, right? If there's a grand on the floor, you're like, you want to pick it up, but is it marked? Is it this? Is it that? Is it who's it belong to? So how did you convince other players that this money was all right?
It's a good question. they may have been marked, but I would have never known that. Yeah. I just knew, there's the money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think my mentality at the time was, let me check that.
Yeah, of course.
Clean or dirty, but
yeah, you're just doing, in your mind, you're just doing your job, right?
I just thought as well, there's no way that they're giving me this amount of money and the marked bills.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Was it a thrill? Was there genuinely a thrill there?
I'll say it wasn't a thrill, it was an addiction, man.
Oh yeah?
Like, I was getting money fast and quick. 45 minutes, 90 minutes. That became an addiction, but I didn't realise when I was becoming addicted to it, what was I actually addicted to? Because it weren't the money after a certain stage. So a lot of it came from power.
At this point, this is like, for people of our generation, this is Scarface type stuff. Yeah. Money's coming, spinning it so quick now, you need to find places to do it. You know that scene in Scarface where they've got the guy over the bank and then he's like, oh, this is great. But then now it's like, there's loads and there's loads and it's like, hold on, there's too much money coming in. Did you ever have that kind of moment?
I don't know whether you've ever felt this, but there was a numbing. Like, it weren't the same buzz I got when I first got it.
Yeah.
There's like, when you're probably illegitimately, when you're making that amount of money, it's like, it's never real. I once said to these guys, I'm not making enough money, and they quickly reminded me, don't be a greedy man. So the lesson I learned, okay, let me just stay in my lane, do what I need to do. I have a number in my mind, but once I went over the first number, I quickly realised, damn man, this ain't enough. I want more, and the cycle just kept going. Going.
The thing is, when we're going through this, I'm putting myself, but I remember hearing these stories.
Oh, really?
I remember hearing these stories. Yeah. But I didn't... You don't think it's as real. Like, it's mythological. It's like, that does happen, but not to those numbers. Do you get what I mean? Like, not people ain't making 100 bags a game in the conference. Do you get what I mean? Like, that's... I don't know, it's maybe naivety, it's maybe the third, fourth hand, so you're thinking... Maybe the number's 15. And then by the time it's got to me, now it's at 100 grand because everyone wants to be bigger and better.
To be honest, it was getting to a point where it was hard to keep a lid on it. Players not involved in the fix were getting wind of rigged matches and they were going and placing bets.
Is that not frustrating? Because we're from an era and a cold where you keep your mouth shut.
You know what, but I can't blame people for... I can't blame you if I don't know you.
Yeah, but that info must have come from someone you did know.
I knew this boss was penetrating these teams, but I didn't know them directly because some of those teams were in Essex, for example.
Yeah.
And that's like miles away from where.
Yeah.
I remember going back to the boss and telling him, and obviously what he said to me was, make them stop going into bookies, but they have to come to us. And I was like, imagine you just finished work on a building site and you're not playing on the weekend, but you know your team's going to lose. Players will go in and put 100 or 200 pounds, but that would raise the detection on the legal markets and say, hold on, there's irregular betting patterns.
Was there anyone else that knew or was like suspicious or going?
Delroy.
Oh, okay.
Delroy Facey.
So I hadn't spoke to Delroy since I'd left Lincoln. So I left Lincoln in 2010-11 season. He rang me. And he said, this is exactly how he said. He said,
yo, bro, what's going on down there?
And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like,
yeah, you know what I'm talking about, what's going on down there?
And I said to him, the league, the fixing stuff. He's like,
yeah, man, like, who's the one that's running things over there?
And I said to him, I don't know, you know, why? Who's told you about that? Or what have you been hearing? And obviously, he already had the mindset in his mind that, you know, let me try and figure something out, so... I don't know who he's talking to. You got to remember, this is the Conference South in 2013. Delroy was playing in Bradford at the time. So when people like him are hearing what's going on, you know it's getting big.
Was there a change in being part of the team to being the guy that organised everything with different people across the leagues in your personality and in the way that they treated you?
Yeah, so with the actual, my teammates.
No, syndicate, okay, purely yeah, syndicate, so forget the football for now.
They stopped having meetings in person because they had so much teams. Anything that happened that was successful, they wanted more. So for example, they'll be like, oh, Moses, what do you think about this player? Or what do you think he can do? That's too far outside of London. I don't know nobody in the Midlands, for example. And they'll be like, well, try and get someone to know him then. I'm like, it don't work like that. You physically can't do it. And they're like, okay, well, if you can't do it, we'll find someone else. There was one time that they've gone and done that and one of their bets didn't come in and the other team had been threatened. One of the text messages I received, they sent me a player's name. This is the first time these things started happening. Sent me a player's name and they were like, yeah, we want to go and see him. Get an address. And I'm like,
wow.
That ain't never been discussed ever.
Yeah.
And this ain't even about fixing now. I was like, no, you know what? The weather here is changing. When you're dealing with match fixers, what would you say the common motivators are?
Boy, I'll tell you, in life, especially in my line of work, sometimes you run across people who simply have the criminal mind. They're not like the rest of us. You know, these people are not focused on making an honest career. Their moral compass is totally askew, or they don't even have one. It's their business, their criminal business, to know as much as they can about you so that they can push all of your buttons, manipulate you, and maneuver you to their end, right?
Next time on Confessions of a Match Fixer.
When you say give them a bullet.
Give them a bullet.
Physical bullet.
Ammunition.
Yeah, so or I was going to say...
They'd give them five players a bullet each to take home.
There's organised crime. These are people that could turn up at any moment and wipe you out. Just a click of finger, you're done.
You've been listening to Sport's Strangest Crimes on BBC Radio 5 Live. You can catch up with the full series now. Just search Confessions of a Match Fixer on BBC Sounds.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Farron Paul's been stabbed 18 times in two separate incidents. But now this knife crime victim has turned campaigner, and he's helping get weapons off the streets. I'm Dan Johnson, I'm a BBC correspondent, and I've spent time with Farron and some of the young men he encounters, as new figures suggest the police are dealing with more large blades, like swords, machetes and zombie knives, around twice as many as 5 years ago. There's also new legislation coming into force, extending the ban on these large zombie-style weapons. So this is 5 minutes on the man taking knives off the streets.
I get calls from all around the UK, about 3-4 a day right now.
He's heading to southeast London to collect a pair of large knives from a young man who's made contact.
You say, my guy, you good? Yeah, I'll put it down, show me you got, my guy.
We're just by some garages on a housing estate, and this 21-year-old, who doesn't want us to use his name, has pulled two huge machetes from his bag. They are maybe 60 centimetres long. He says he's kept them in his wardrobe for the last 2 years.
Why have you got weapons like that?
I bought them to protect myself a while ago after I got attacked and kidnapped. I got stabbed 12 times.
Why did you need something so large?
I mean, when I was kidnapped, they had weapons the same size. So I thought, if that ever happens again, those same people, then I need something to combat that, realistically. But I feel like the police can't protect myself. Yeah, I've got to protect myself, really, yeah.
Bro, appreciate you, yeah? Stay safe. Happy team, right?
Farron will make sure that they're destroyed.
We've retrieved the weapons. The tubes are actually not even long enough to properly contain these weapons.
We've discovered the number of swords, machetes and zombie knives logged by the police has almost doubled in 5 years to more than 14,000. And they're being used in violent crimes, robberies, assaults, public order offences, stalking and harassment. And last year, 23 people were killed using one of those bigger weapons.
That is from a young person.
How old?
15, 16.
At his office, Farron's showing me some of what he's collected. Swords, daggers and zombie-style machetes with curving, colourful blades.
I just feel like it's the way that all the serrated edges are coming in now, and it's just the sheer weight of them, man.
The difficulty in tackling this growing problem is illustrated when Farron tries to drop these weapons into knife bins.
Look, it just goes right to the back. Look, the handle's here.
It just won't fit.
It just won't go in there, look.
So what's your only option with that now?
Now, this would have to be physically taken to the police station and given in over the counter.
There's another call, another young man wanting to hand over a large machete.
Hey, big up yourself, man.
He's got it hidden inside his coat. He says he's carried knives since childhood. We're using an actor's voice.
I got a Rambo knife when I was about 16. Everyone walks around with them to look after themselves, really. They feel like they need to. They're scared. When people get chopped up, people get hurt.
And where are they getting the weapons?
You can get them off friends. You can get them online. It's so easy to get a knife. You can get it delivered to your house like a takeaway.
And why is it getting worse?
If you've got a bigger weapon, you've got more of a chance. If you have a flick knife and someone pulls a Rambo out on you, then you're going to be thinking, then why don't I get a bigger one, you know what I mean?
The new ban covers anything over 20 centimetres, which also has a serrated edge, spikes, holes in the blade, or more than two sharp points. But this is not the first attempt to ban zombie-style weapons.
The biggest threat I see is the online space.
Commander Steve Claymans, the National Police Chief's Council lead on knife crime.
Manufacturers quite cleverly got around the design.
Why will this ban be any different?
Well, it will have an impact. I can't say, you know, it will be the end of the issue, because it clearly won't.
So you could see further legislation?
Yeah, quite possibly, yeah.
Here he is. Farron's returning from another late-night pickup.
See you, my guy.
Good evening. How'd you get on?
I'll show you. We collected all these knives for one person.
All from the same person?
Yeah, all from the same person. We've got that Z case.
Zombie knife?
Yeah, that's a zombie knife right there.
It is quite a collection. There are 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 weapons. Different styles and sizes, but they're all pretty gruesome, all capable of serious damage.
This is relatively normal now. These are the designer knives that young people are drawn to and what they're buying.
The government says knife crime is a key priority, but there's no doubting the scale of this challenge. How do you feel taking those off the streets?
It makes me feel good. It makes me feel like, you know, if it's actually helped this person in this situation, then it's a good thing. And it also motivates me to keep doing more, you know. Yeah, it's a little bit of success for me against the fight of knife crime.
Thanks for listening. For more podcasts like this, why not subscribe to 5 Minutes On? It's available on BBC Sounds.
That's not any old hammering. It's Jack Millington opening a giant tanning drum in a barn in Leicestershire. In goes goat and deer hides that otherwise would go to waste. Out comes the beginnings of quality leather to be made into bags and wallets. But who needs a wallet or purse when we're going cash-free? 3/4 of 16 to 24-year-olds regularly use their smartphone or watch to pay for things. I'm Kevin Peachey, the BBC's cost of living correspondent, and I've been to see Jack, once dubbed the hipster tanner, who says there's still a market out there. This is 5 Minutes On, making wallets cool again.
This is our micro tannery, which if people have heard of a micro brewery or a micro distillery, the whole idea with this is that this is the equivalent for leather and for tanning.
And most people won't have a tannery on the end of their street. So tell us a bit about the industry here in the UK.
So the leather industry used to be a huge part of the economy in the UK, but like a lot of manufacturing type businesses over the decades, they've got sort of outcompeted by lower cost competition from abroad. And I think that's kind of been the sad story with tanneries as well. And they are closing down every year still now. And we're probably one of a handful, a maximum of sort of maybe five in the UK that are doing things like we are. And that's down from sort of hundreds even in the sort of 70s.
Do you like that idea of being a hipster tanner? Why do you get called that?
Well, I didn't love it at first, to be honest, but the whole point is that we're trying to do something creative with an old industry, which I guess kind of fits the title, perhaps.
And tell us what you are doing here. What is going on?
So here you can hear the drum spinning. That is our tanning drum, and essentially it's a big wooden washing machine, and we use that to tan the leather. We take what is left over from the meat, and through various processes here in the tannery, we turn that hide into high quality leather that we can then turn into various products.
So let's step back outside, and we've got some of the products over here. Tell us a little bit about what you create.
So yeah, we specialise in goat leather and in deer leather, and we use that for a range of products. So from everything from bags to wallets, we make here in the UK from our leather.
Now talk to me about wallets. We're all using phones, aren't we? We've all gone cashless. Sure, is there any call for a wallet?
Well, you'd have thought so, but actually we found great success selling wallets. I think it's one of those timeless items that everyone owns and wants to have for a long time. And when we launched the business back in 2017, we started just with a card holder because I just use a card holder. I don't carry much cash.
You're in your 30s, right?
So. Well, at the time I was in my 20s, so I definitely wasn't really using much cash. And it's been funny though, over the years we kept getting requests for a more classic wallet that could hold cash. So we launched that a few years ago, and I'm always surprised at quite how many of those we sell as well.
Where do you think that demand comes from?
Well, I think it tends to be a slightly older customer who still wants to carry cash or still has the option to carry cash. And I just think, yeah, that leather's one of those materials that will last for a long time, and people want to have a quality item that is sort of tactile like leather is, that they carry around with them.
And what do you see as this business? It's clearly trying to use products that otherwise would have gone to waste. Is that part of your philosophy here?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that was the whole reason that Billy Tannery started was when I discovered that waste of hides, and that's kind of part of the sustainability story that we tell is making use of a material that would otherwise go in the bin and turning it into something like high quality leather that can last for decades if looked after properly.
Picture a scene of the future for us in terms of wallets and purses and aprons and so on. Are you going to be making them in 10, 20 years' time?
Well, I hope so. I mean, we always develop different products to suit different times. I think I don't think that the wallet is dead yet. I think we'll see at least a card holder. I think we'll be there for plenty of time to come. And we've looked at making cases for phones and everything, but it just doesn't quite fit with that ethos of something that's going to last for a long time. Because every time you change your phone, you're changing your case, and it just ends up being a bit throwaway.
Something to keep, even if cash may not be with us for that much longer.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening. You can read more about the money in our pockets or purses on the BBC News website. And for more like this, subscribe to this podcast, 5 Minutes On. We'll be right back.
UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
For the BBC News at 1 o'clock, this is Richard Lawson. The death of the leader of Hezbollah has been described as a historic turning point by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Hassan Nasrallah was killed in Israeli airstrikes on his group's headquarters in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Netanyahu said the killing was evidence his country was winning its fight against its enemies.
We settled the score with the one responsible for the murder of countless Israelis and many citizens of other countries, including hundreds of Americans and dozens of French. Nasrallah's elimination is an essential condition to achieve the goals we have set.
And Iran, which backs Hezbollah, has announced 5 days of mourning and called for an emergency meeting at the UN. The MP for Canterbury, Rosie Duffield, has resigned from the Labour Party and told the BBC that the Prime Minister's team cares more about greed than making a difference. There have been days of revelations about donations, including thousands of pounds of clothing gifted to Sir Keir Starmer. In a BBC interview, Ms. Duffield said she felt voters and activists were being taken for granted. Well, our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus, has been reading her resignation letter.
Her letter is deeply critical about Sir Keir Starmer's policies, the cuts which she says will affect the poorest, and which she says are cruel and unnecessary. His leadership, she says, is uninspiring. And accepting gifts, she says that sleaze, nepotism and avarice are off the scale.
Three people have been charged with the murder of a man who was stabbed to death in Norwich. The body of Calvin Taylor, who was 19, was found in a flat last Saturday, and the suspects are due to appear before magistrates on Monday. A hurricane that swept through several of America's southeastern states has killed at least 53 people, including 7 in Florida. The state's governor, Ron DeSantis, described it as a gut punch to coastal communities.
In this part of the state, we saw really monumental storm surge in excess of 15 feet. And that is really, really destructive. So as you look around here, you know, you see some homes that are now